So I appreciate that. Appreciate being able to talk to the farmers. That's where I'm most at home, so I appreciate the opportunity. I try to spend my time just telling you my observations of where everything's at in Washington. I think a lot of people are always curious about that. And John Newton's coming behind me, and I think we're going to have maybe some people on the phone from Senate Agriculture Committee. So I'll let them talk about the details of it. So just let me talk about the atmosphere in Washington a little bit. You know, it's really an exciting time to be there. Some of you may have heard me talk about my first year in Washington and under a previous administration. There was very little interaction. I did speak to the Secretary of Agriculture a couple times that year, and most of the time it was him calling me wanting something, and it was, you know, it was just kind of hard to break through that, and we had absolutely no communication between myself and the White House at that time. But this is a new era. This president's brought open doors to our organization and to agriculture across town. And by the way, you know, a lot of people think about agriculture in Washington. The agriculture community is like a little small town inside of a big city. I mean, it really is close-knit. We work together a lot, commodity groups and other groups, and that's important. This administration really has been open to us, and what's great about that gives us the opportunity to take your policies that you work so hard on in your states and in your county level, and it lets us infuse them into the process of making policy. And that's exactly the way it's supposed to work. So we've got great opportunities with this administration. So I'll talk a little bit about the people that this administration have put in important seats, and along with that, talk about some of the issues. I'm going to start at the Department of Interior. How many people we got here from west of the Mississippi? Okay, we got a few. I'll tell you, as my travels through American agriculture, and I've been to all 50 states in Puerto Rico, I've taken a real interest in Western issues because I was so unaware of them. And you know how something new always intrigues you. So I've taken a real big interest in Western issues because I had the most to learn in that area. You have some really big challenges, and a lot of it is around federal lands and endangered species. And we have some in the East. We have some difficulties with endangered species, but not nearly to the tone level that y'all do out West. So in Department of Interior, Mr. Zinke was appointed. He comes from Montana. A Navy SEAL and has been in Congress. I actually had the opportunity to sit down with him for about an hour, I guess it's been a couple of weeks ago, in his office. And we talked about his reorganization of his department. Sounds very exciting. Sounds like it makes a lot of common sense. Sounds like it might bring a lot of opportunity for our producers to have more input into the policies being made or how they're being enforced out in that area. So I think we have some really, really good opportunities to gain some ground and get some more open communication between our producers and the Department of Interior when it comes to those issues. His reorganization, he's real excited about it. It's not a cheap thing to do. It's very expensive to do what he's going to do, but he thinks it's for the best of the Department of Interior and for the people that work with them. So we're looking forward to helping him move forward with that reorganization within the Department of Interior. Of course, Ryan Yates tells me, and he spent about an hour with me explaining to me all the different pieces of legislation that are out there that we can help work on endangered species. And he says he's never remembered a time when there was that many pieces of legislation. Now, will they all become laws? Probably not. But if we just move the needle on a few, it can make a huge difference on the landscape across America. So we're looking forward to that opportunity. We're having opportunities there we haven't had in the past, so that's exciting. So endangered species, inside of that is a regulatory reform. Of course, so I'll roll over into the EPA with Mr. Pruitt. All of y'all probably have had the opportunity to see him speak somewhere because he's been not as much travel as the Secretary of Agriculture, but he's traveled quite a bit. And he and I have become friends. He and I have had lunch a couple of times. actually the week before the we did the budget meeting, the budget amendment back in February, about 2 weeks before that, he and I met and talked about EPCRA and CERCLA, and he wanted to understand from producer's point of view how all that's going to affect us. And he totally agreed with my observations of it. So he totally agrees with our policy on that. And, you know, we work a lot of times in Farm Bureau, and we have some successes, and we never talk about them. We move on to the next issue. Well, in EPCRA and CERCLA, we had wins in that during February. So we should be talking about that win, because that's really huge to our farmers and ranchers out there, offsetting what would have been a very cumbersome reporting of emissions, even for my cattle or wherever it might be. So, you know, that is a huge win, and we had a big opportunity to be a part of that decision making. So we're glad to get that done. Of course, you can't talk about EPA without talking about WOTUS. WOTUS is, even though it's been a year and several months since the president has signed the executive order to dismantle it, it's still we're still in the middle of that struggle. And the struggle is not to get it done or not. It's to get it done in a way that it can meet legal challenges, that it can withstand a different administration going in there. Because the last thing we needed for it to do is get hung up in court, have a new administration go in there, probably, if so, another party at some time in the future, and reverting right back to where we're at. We need to fix this where that, and try to make that as difficult as possible so that we don't end up in the same situation we've been in. WOTUS is probably the biggest federal land grab ever in any ruling that's ever come through the federal government. And we all know, and our organization has been heavily involved in our grassroots, probably never been as activated on any issue more than they were in WOTUS with Ditch the Rule. So we really appreciate the work y'all have done, but the work is not over. But the opportunities in this is that this administration and this EPA actually call Farm Bureau. I mean, they call us, they email us. Ellen Steen and Don Parrish have been very active in helping them weed through the process of doing this and doing it right. I guess the only downside of that to Mr. Pruitt, he's not a patient man. He wants it done yesterday. And this is something that's going to take time to do it right in a way that it doesn't come back to haunt us in the past. And that's what we keep encouraging. And we're trying to make sure all those loopholes get tightened up and we do it in the right way where it can withstand the legal challenges. You will be seeing here within probably the next month a request for a supplemental comment period. And we're going to be encouraging everyone to make comments on it. It's going to be just as important as the first comment period, because I promise you our enemies are going to be there. And this supplemental comment period is one of the things that we encourage them to do to try to make it more foolproof or when it comes to the law side of it. So when we make a call for you to make comments, please make sure that you spend a little time. In your own words, it doesn't take much to make sure that we make comments on withdrawing this rule. And then, of course, the second step of that is write a new rule. And the administrator and I talked a lot about what that new rule ought to do. And I told him, I said, I know this is simplified, but what we need is a ruling that when our farmers ride out into the field after they've read it, they can interpret on themselves. They can decide themselves whether or not their land is part of WOTUS or not. We don't need to be hiring lawyers and consultants and spending hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to decide and then try to defend it against our federal government. So, and he totally understood how it needed to be simple so that it wouldn't cost us a fortune when it's implemented. So I think we got really, really good opportunity to do this. Hopefully we can do it right. And hopefully it can last for a long, long time and get that in the background. So then we, of course, Farm Bill, and I know John will talk a lot about numbers, whether it be around Farm Bill and other things later on, and I won't pick that up. But I'll talk about the Secretary of Agriculture while we talk about Farm Bill. We should be celebrating. Last week was a great week. You know, if you look at last week, And you look at our top four priorities, which is farm labor, it was discussed last week. Trade, it was discussed last week. Farm bill, it was discussed last week. And then regulatory reform. So three out of our top four priority issues at American Farm Bureau were being talked about last week. So the farm bill passed out of the House by a squeaking vote, and all of y'all know that if you're even listening to the news by one vote, really, because if one vote had to change its mind, then you know what that would have meant. So we were really proud to get that passed. I think Chairman Conaway and his staff and his Ag Committee did a fantastic job. Unfortunately, it wasn't bipartisan. We would hoped it would have been bipartisan. And now we're going to be rushing out of here later in the morning to get back to Washington, because we're talking about it on the Senate side this week. And hopefully, it won't take but one vote this time. And hopefully, there's several harmful amendments out there we want to make sure that we fight off. And I want to say that I just come from Louisiana. And Louisiana expressed to me in the hall, in meetings, all over the place, how much they appreciated American Farm Bureau's help on fighting back the sugar amendment. I want to use that as an example of what this organization is all about. When there's an amendment on the floor that's harmful to a commodity, it doesn't make any difference what area it comes for. We as a Farm Bureau family need to be fighting that amendment or that law or that ruling. That's what makes us strong. When you got cotton farmers trying to help sugar farmers, or corn farmers trying to help sugar farmers, and vice versa, when we're talking about RFS and other things that are needed in other parts of the country, that's when we as a family really show our strength and really gain a lot of respect in town, because we can come with one voice. So that's really, really important, and I know that Louisiana people really appreciated the involvement that American Farm Bureau had and the part we played in help fighting that back, and hopefully we can continue to fight that back. It just amazes me how fake news is fake news, because all I could hear about, well, how bad the sugar program was and how much it cost the taxpayers. Well, that's so ridiculous. It's the only program out there that doesn't cost the taxpayers anything except for 1 year. It's just amazing how they can just stand up and lie about it. I don't know how they can do that, but they do that. And really and truly, I think it's a program we ought to be shaping other commodity programs around. So in the Department of Agriculture, of course, we've got Sonny Perdue, and Sonny Perdue's done a fantastic job. I think all of y'all would agree on that. He's probably been most of your state. If he hadn't, he's coming. He's a good friend of mine. I've spent a lot of time with Sonny, and if I need him, I can text him. And most of the time, he's better if I text him on the weekend, because they keep him pretty stretched out. But he's doing a great job. He's got some huge challenges in front of him as far as organizationally with that department, USDA, because it's such a big department. And he's trying to bring some efficiencies to it. And some of the things he's found has been, if you knew what they were, you would be appalled. And I know he is, and he's trying to fix a lot of difficult structural things within USDA, and then trying to do a good job representing American agriculture. I will tell you, and as I use this conversation, I move into trade. If it had not been for Sonny Perdue, the burden that we carry on these trade issues would be hundredfold heavier. Because he is the calming, common sense, very forceful voice within the cabinet. And to bring the truth to that, I actually had an opportunity to visit one-on-one with the vice president last Thursday. And he says, y'all are so fortunate to have Sonny Perdue in the cabinet room. He's the one that tries to keep them calm and brings a definite understanding of how agriculture is on the point of the sword when it comes to trade. So let's talk about trade just for a minute. And you can tell me if I'm wrong, because I'm really on a listening tour a little bit as I travel around. What I hear is our farmers are still with this president. They want this president to be successful. Some of them will go even to the point telling me, don't you be critical, let him do his job. We can handle a little bit of this. And then, of course, there's some that's financially strapped a little tighter, and they're saying, I can't take a whole lot more. So my explanation to the vice president the other day was, every time a combine cranks up from now to the time we have prime harvest time, is a time period and a window that draws narrower and narrower with the patience of our farmers. Because we have a perfect storm brewing, and this is exactly what I told him. The perfect storm is we don't have a farm bill yet. We're hoping we're going to get one, but if we don't get one, that's going to be a terrible storm within that big storm. We don't have a fix for our immigration problem, our farm labor problem. And that is a problem we really don't see getting fixed, but we're working hard to try to find some solutions to it. That's another big part of that storm. These trade treaties with all these tariffs are affecting the markets just off of a whim, whether it's a news report or whether it's a tweet from the president or Mr. Lighthizer. It's affecting the markets, and we're already at 50% of our farm income from 5 years ago. And that would be a huge storm if those continue. And if we go into the fall with prices depressed even more than what they are today, that would be a big storm. We have a perfect storm brewing, Mr. President. And the only way you're going to be able to head that off in your, with your administration, where you're at, is to do something positive in trade. And I'm not talking about threatening and rattling a saber and making threats and just sitting down and negotiating. You have to finish something. Because our farmers plant a crop, they go all year long on a glimmer of hope that they're going to harvest a crop and be able to sell it at a profit. And I said, they're scrapping to try to find some hope right now. So my ask to the vice president was make sure the president understood how important it is to finish up a trade agreement with our southern neighbors and our northern neighbors. And if he does that and does it in a timely manner, it will give our farmers hope. And then move on to what we think, and he thinks, also he agreed with me, that we realize that China is a longer battle. And I said, there are certain commodities that are going to get killed in this China deal. And I called the numbers of $14 billion of soybeans going into China, one out of every three rows. I called out cotton because there's about $1 billion worth of cotton going in there. I called out pork because there's about $700 million worth of pork going in there. And there's others, but those three major commodities are going to get clobbered if this continues. So the message is, please, we don't care whether it's NAFTA or two bilaterals. Let's trade with our neighbors. Let's get it done. Let's get it done in a timely manner. Let's get it signed. Let's give our farmers some hope. And let's show the world that someone can actually negotiate with this president and finish a deal. Because we really hadn't finished anything yet. We got to finish something. And I says, if you think that these farmers are going to continue to support this administration if that perfect storm hits during this midterm election, you better be thinking twice. Because if this storm hits, I'm afraid this administration will not have American agriculture behind them going into this midterm election. And I said that would be a dark day, not just for this administration, but for this country, because we believe in the direction you're taking this country. Now, if I'm wrong in that observation, I want some of you to tell me when I get into questions and answers, because through our surveying, through me trying to talk to our state presidents, through just trying to listen to our members, that's what I'm hearing right now. And I think our message has to be, Mr. President, we're behind you, but we need for you to timely fix some of these trade problems, because trade is really where our future is. And I know technology plays a big part of that. There's a lot of things that play a big part of that. But we can grow it, produce it, and be the best in the world, but if we can't trade it and sell it, you know, we're still going to be at a depressed price, and we're all going to be scratching to try to make a living. So you know, this is an exciting time to be in Washington. Are we vulnerable? Yes, we're vulnerable. Have we always been vulnerable? Extremely vulnerable. But with this administration, the opportunity for us to sit at the table and infuse your policy in there, it gives us great opportunity to make a difference. And I'll challenge you to think back over the last five presidents. I'll challenge you to think about how many times you heard them even mention agriculture in their daily discussions or meetings. Really and truly? End of Carter, beginning of Reagan, embargo, a little bit, yep, quite a bit of talk. But outside of that, no one has talked about agriculture since then. This president talks about it weekly. That's encouraging to me. And I'll tell you one other thing that Mr. Perdue told me the last time we met. He said, you know, the president's worried about us. And he says, I know he's worried about us because he called me at 11 o'clock the other night. And he says, you know, when President Trump calls you, you don't really talk, you just listen. He says, he talked for an hour about our farmers. He says, so why would a president at 11 o'clock at night call the Secretary of Agriculture if he wasn't concerned about us? He wouldn't. With all the things he's got on his plate between North Korea and China and all the things that's going on around ISIS and around the world, but he spends an hour on the phone with the Secretary of Agriculture talking about agriculture and farmers. I think we're in a good place, people. I think we're very tense and nervous. I think we have great opportunity. And that, and I'll quit with this, that tells you that engagement in this organization and help us push in your policy and your messages is more important today with the opportunity to have success today than we've ever had. And shame on us if we miss the opportunity. Shame on us. And I don't think we will. We've had great response, but we don't need everybody to relax. WOTUS is not gone yet. This trade deal is not too far gone that we can't reap some real benefits out of it. We're getting close to a farm bill, and it's not going to be easy because the conference committee is going to be brutal. But we got so many opportunities, but the success is going to be determined by how much involvement we get from our grassroots. Because I'll promise you, and I assure you, that the people in Washington that work for you at your American Farm Bureau is working their tails off trying to make sure that something positive happens. And we've already had some really good positive things happen. We don't celebrate those successes enough. You know, a lot of little successes build up to a big success, and that's what we want. But we got to talk about those little ones too, to re-encourage us to continue on that battle. So I'll stop right there, Carl, and see if there's any questions.
Great. Any quick questions for President Duvall?
And my question to you is, am I on the right track? Have I heard our grassroots right? Anybody disagree with that? You're not going to hurt my feelings. I want to make sure I'm doing the right job for you. Sounds like we're on the right track. Yes, sir. So I got a really good feeling from the conversations that I've had within the White House that we're really close in Mexico. If something doesn't just fall apart, probably in the next 60 days, and I'm going way out on a limb, but I feel pretty good about that. And then they got a strong feeling that if they can close something with Mexico, that Canada's going to want in. They're going to want to come in. It's going to draw them in. And we don't, really and truly, we don't care whether it's NAFTA or two bilaterals. We just need the trade deals. And I really think politically this president needs to say, I told you NAFTA was bad. I got rid of it, and I got two really good bilaterals. Politically, that's probably what it's going to look like. I've always thought that all along. China, long term, very brutal. Could be years. That's why I worry about certain commodities that has a lot of trade going in there now. And then, of course, I think none of us in this room really know, you know, agricultural trade, trade with China, nuclear battle on, not battle, but the fight to get rid of the nukes on the Korean Peninsula, all the civilians that's been locked up in Korea. None of us know how all that intertwines. None of us. And I just can't imagine how challenging that is to keep all that on the front and end up having something positive come out at the end. So, you know, my hat's off to them. They got a tremendous big job. Hope that helped. And it's all just off of what the feeling I get now.
We'll take one more zip.
Okay. Yes, sir.
But trade war with China, I think at some point, hopefully doesn't go worse than this as this day. Where do you see that going? And you're saying often years, can our farmers last years with a trade war potentially escalating with China?
I think that's going to be heavily dependent on whether we can get a, how quick we can get a Mexican Canada trade deals. If we can get that done and show the rest of the world that this president is, can negotiate and close a deal on trade, then I think we're going to move on to other countries. We've got great opportunities in the United Kingdom, in the European Union, be a little bit more difficult. And Mr. McKinney's here tomorrow, and I won't steal his thunder, but every time I talk to him, he talks about how big India could be, but very difficult. So, I think the word is buckle up tight on China because it's going to be rough. That's the word I've been told. So a couple of things I didn't tell you really need to know, and I can blow an agenda. I'm sorry, Carl. But Greg Dowd, who took the USTR ag the negotiator spot at USTR, Greg, you know, been on the ground about 2 months, 2.5 months now. Greg's one of us. His dad is a grain farmer. I think in Kansas, I'm not sure. Greg gets it. He's a markets guy, so he knows markets. And one of the things he's told me, it stuck with me, that really encouraged me is he says, one of the things I put on my weekly list to do is to walk into the office with Mr. Lighthizer and take the markets with me and show him how this article affected the markets, this tweet affected the markets, how vulnerable our markets are. And he says, I promise you, he gets it now. And he says, he didn't get it before. So they are getting that information fed to them. They understand better how vulnerable we are there. Then I get worried when I hear Wilbur Ross, the Treasury, say, well, the farmers are going to do well. They're going to sell more than they've ever sold before. It's just going to be at a cheaper price. Well, for God's sake, if I sell more and I'm not making a profit at, what good is it? I mean, is he really our treasurer guy that said that? I mean, I read that and scratched my head. I said, man, he went to a different school than I did. Obviously, it wasn't a hard knock school like I did because that don't work. So, you know, that concerns all over about that. Anything else? So I'll leave you with this, because I try to encourage our people how important it is for us to just stay engaged. I mean, we are only as strong as your engagement with our organization. Ecclesiastes 4:12, the Bible tells us, though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a third folded cord is not quickly broken. That's our county, that's our state, and that's our American Farm Bureau. That three cord, if we stay tangled together, I mean, that is so true in our religious life with our faith, and so true in our real life here that in using our organization for us to be successful. If we stand together and we help each other, there ain't nobody's gonna break this cord. And we're here, and I promise you, your American Farm Bureau, and it is your American Farm Bureau, is doing all it can do to take advantage of the opportunities that are right in front of us or within grasp and make sure that we have positive outcome. Carl, thank you for allowing me to come, and I'm going to sit through some of the morning, and I'll be off back to Washington and try to see if I can help the Senate side a little bit. So thank you, Carl.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you, President Duvall. And before we get into our next speakers, as you can see, they're going to join us through WebEx. But in agriculture, we talk what's going on. We're not hearing what's happening in the media with agriculture. We know prices are, we're struggling out there. But the thing is, with American Farm Bureau and the State Farm Bureau's involved in that same process, there's so much that can be done behind the scenes to educate people on moving these trade issues or whatever issues we have, that we just feel it's much more effective to talk to those individuals and educate instead of going out there in the media and just start blasting someone for something that we don't know all the details on. So, Zippy, thank you. Yes, it is a very contentious issue right now that we're dealing with. It affects our livelihoods in every way possible. But we have to remember, the administration does trade deals. Congress approves them. So with that, we have with us Joe Schultz. He's with the Senate Ag Committee from Senator Stabenow's office. Joe serves as a Democratic staff director of the U.S. Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry under the leadership of ranking member Senator Debbie Stabenow. During the writing of the 2014 Farm Bill, Schultz serves as chief economist for the committee and led the Chairwoman Stabenow's work on issues related to commodity programs, federal crop insurance, the federal budget, and global food security. Schultz grew up on a fourth-generation farm in western Ohio. He earned his bachelor's degree in agriculture economics from Ohio State University and his master's degree in applied economics from Cornell University. Also with Joe, we have Matt Erickson, everyone is quite familiar with. And Matt is with the Senate Ag Committee for Senator Roberts' office. And Matt previously served as an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation. Also, Matt worked in USDA's Rural Development Office during the George W. Bush administration. Now he serves as the chief economist for the Senate Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee on Senator Peter's staff. So with that, we would like to introduce these individuals, and they're going to give us a little insight on what they see happening in the Farm Bill. So gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to hearing your comments.
Thanks for having us. Good morning, everyone. How's everyone doing? Oh, good. There's not that much lag. Well, it's glad to, Joe and I are glad to be with you, even though it's not in person, but we're here in Washington via conference call and video conference with you all. First, before we make our comments and everything, I think, you know, on behalf of Chairman Roberts and Ranking Member Stabenow, we just want to thank you all for your continued work and commitment towards getting this farm bill across the finish line. Quite frankly, this farm bill wouldn't be accomplished unless, you know, the grassroots movement of Farm Bureau was in place, if the states were advocating for farmers and ranchers all across the country and for American Farm Bureau to do what they do and to make sure that they're serving your interest in the policy at the national level. So really kudos for you all. Just wanted to kind of give brief remarks here. Unfortunately, we have a fire drill in about 10 minutes. So we have to evacuate the building, and
it's actually a literal fire drill.
Yeah. So it's a great way to start the farm bill process for floor consideration. So just knowing that we have that, I'll turn it over to Joe here briefly, but just want to make a real quick point with regard to this bipartisan farm bill. When Chairman Roberts and Ranking Member Stabenow first started this Farm Bill process back in the chairman's home state of Kansas, there were three things that the chairman was very adamant and very committed to do with this Farm Bill. One was to make sure that we produce a Farm Bill for all regions and all commodities. And at least for Chairman Roberts, he's been to every geographical region in the United States. He does not want to see a regional fight within this farm bill. He's traveled to Alabama, where former Senator Strange's home state was, went to Senator Daines's home state, Montana. And then we went to Michigan for the second field hearing. And then we led off our field hearings in Manhattan, Kansas. So first and foremost, making sure that we have producer certainty and a farm bill for all regions and all commodities. Second, and probably one of the most important ones in this environment in Washington, is making sure we have a bipartisan farm bill. And, you know, I think it really speaks volumes of the chairman and the ranking member on how well we work together within this process. Quite frankly, bipartisanship is not easy to do, but we accomplished it. And we want to see this moving forward here and getting it passed here on the Senate floor this week, and then moving on to conference with the House here, hopefully here next month in that time frame. So getting a chairman's mark out of committee with a vote of 20-1, I think it really speaks volumes of the leadership between Chairman Roberts and Ranking Member Stabenow. And then the third thing would be to make sure that we have a farm bill that's budget neutral and one that's making good use of taxpayer money. So with all those three things, I think those are really important for the chairman with regard to proceeding with the farm bill and making sure that we have a good product. I think with that, because we're limited on time, I'm going to turn it over to Joe to see if he has any remarks.
Sure. Just very briefly, one, thanks for letting us dial in and talk to all of you. Carl, President Benarski, thanks for having us. Thanks for not holding against me that I'm a Buckeye. I deeply appreciate that. today we are kicking off an incredibly important part of the Farm Bill process here in the Senate. Tonight we will take our first procedural vote, and I won't get into the parliamentary procedure of the Senate, but it is a procedural vote, but it is going to be an important symbolic vote as to the support for our farm bill. And I am confident, and we will all know around 6 o'clock this evening how we do, but I am confident that we're going to have a very strong bipartisan vote. And we get bipartisan votes and strong supports for the farm bill when we have a good work product, and we do. And I tell you, bipartisanship is hard, and it takes time, and it takes listening, and it takes compromise, both things that can sometimes be in short order in Washington, D.C. But we have a great partnership with Chairman Roberts and Senator Stabenow, and we have a great bipartisan bill to show for it. And bipartisan legislation comes from a bipartisan and good process. And I think that's what we're going to talk a lot about, which is Matt mentioned the listening, the hearings that we held both in Frankenmuth in Michigan and in Manhattan, Kansas, reaching out to the members of our Agriculture Committee from a lot of your states, as well as senators and interest groups and farm groups from all over the country. And so we're going to be able to say when we go to the floor tonight to kick off the Senate Farm Bill process that we have the support of hundreds of groups. And we have the support of dozens of senators from both sides of the aisle. And that's incredibly important because we are going to have a tax on this farm bill. There are going to be a tax to things like the sugar program, to crop insurance, to other commodity programs, to checkoff programs, all things that we care deeply about. And the only way we're going to be able to fight off those attacks is with a broad bipartisan coalition that includes not only Democrats and Republicans, but includes farm groups and conservation groups, rural development groups, clean energy groups, trade groups, nutrition groups, everybody that makes that big, broad farm bill coalition, we're going to need if we're going to have the votes to fight off some of these amendments that are going to try to attack and undermine the good bipartisan deal that Senator Stabenow and Senator Roberts put together earlier this month. So that is our job this week. Is to defend this product and to work with people who want to try to get to yes. And we'll keep you updated. But as Matt said, we need your help. As President Duvall said, we need your grassroots activation and engagement in this process to make sure that the tough votes we win and then we keep this farm bill process moving forward. So with that, I'll stop. And I think we're happy to take some questions.
Okay, if there are any questions, raise your hand. We have a mic that will go around so everyone can hear your question. No questions on the farm bill. Oh, here we go.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
I was just wanting your office's version of the trade wars that are going on right now, the tariffs back and forth, and the effects of ag, and just your side of what's going on right now in Washington on that.
Yeah, well, I think it's creating a tremendous amount of instability in the marketplace. We've seen that with soybean prices. And it's creating a lot of uncertainty for our producers. And I think that given the low commodity prices and what we have going on right now, that's a real problem. And so I think, you know, what we have to offer in terms of a farm bill is going to address some of those issues. We're not going to fix trade policy in a farm bill. That's largely run and directed by the administration. That's run out of the White House. But what we can do, to Matt's point, is provide some predictability and some stability for producers who are facing some pretty uncertain times at the moment. And we do that through the Farm Safety Net. And we can also do that by expanding our trade promotion programs. And that's something that we've talked about, and Chairman Roberts has been a champion for, is how do we expand programs like the MAP and FMD program to expand export opportunities overseas for producers. And I think those are the sorts of things you're going to see in our farm bill that try to address some of that trade uncertainty.
Okay, Zippy?
Yeah, President Duvall, that's a really good question. And I think, you know, looking back at the 14 Farm Bill, you know, I'll be frank with you all. There was a regional fight within the 14 Farm Bill. But I think when you look at the bigger picture during the 14 Farm Bill, that's when farm income was at record highs. And I think now the bigger picture here is getting the certainty and predictability of getting a Farm Bill done. That has to be the first and foremost thing. That's what we're thinking. That's what our bosses are thinking. That's what farm groups need to be thinking. And that's what you guys are thinking when we meet with you all up here on the Hill to get a good bipartisan product. I would say the second thing is, you know, there's issues like trade. You know, the soybean market here last week, you know, soybeans are down to $8.80 a bushel, and corn is below the PLC reference price. And so, you know, I think when you look at the farm economy as a whole, you look at where prices are now, you look at the trade environment that's going on, we have to have a farm bill. And we have to stave off these regional fights that can come into an existence within a farm bill debate. So I think with those three things, I think we can accomplish it. If there is going to be a regional fight, we're not going to be successful in getting this thing done.
Yeah,
and I think that's kind of my clear message, you know, to this group, is making sure that you stick together as one alliance, as one group, and seeing the big picture and getting this farm bill done.
Yeah, and I think to Matt's point, that is the theme for this entire bill, beyond just the commodity title, which is if we want to stick together, that means all parts of the Farm Bill coalition. And I think that's one of the big differences you'll see in the Senate versus the House. The House is going down a path where one part of the Farm Bill coalition related to nutrition is not in support of the Farm Bill. And that puts them on a very precarious path. You know, one vote separated the difference between success and failure. We do not want to be in that position in the Senate. And that's why you're going to see that nutrition groups and conservation groups, as well as our farm groups, are supportive of this Farm Bill. And we need everyone in that coalition to be a part of it if we're going to have the votes and if we're going to have the strength in this process to actually get it done. And so I think that's the biggest difference. As we think about this coalition building, it is about all regions of the country. It's also about all parts of the Farm Bill. And how do we keep everybody together? How do we have the biggest, strongest coalition possible so that when we are on the floor of the Senate and we're taking hard votes, say on sugar, that we have everybody with us? And that's going to be Matt and I's job and the rest of your Senate Ag Committee staff as we head into this week.
Another question?
Yes.
That's a great question. And I think, I think from, my boss's standpoint, the chairman's standpoint, is we can't speak for the House, but what we can do is speak for our bosses. And what our bosses want is a bipartisan effort. Frankly, over here, we've got to have 60 votes to get a farm bill. And, with that, I think when we go to conference, the more votes that we have on this farm bill, the more, the more pushing forward that we have for our final product. So I think, the importance of getting, a bipartisan bill first and foremost for our bosses, I think, to me, it says something before we go to conference.
Yeah, I think a strong vote makes a difference. And I'll just be honest, the bill that the House passed has a 0% chance of passing the Senate. We will either have a bipartisan bill that finally passes, or we will have no bill. There is no partisan farm bill that passes the Senate, and that's not bluster or prediction. That's math. Mm-hmm. We need 60 votes, and that by the math that we have means we're going to have a bipartisan bill, and that means a bipartisan process. So I think that's the path that we're going to head down. Because that's what we have to do if we're going to get something passed.
Any other questions for these gentlemen? Okay, seeing none, Matt and Joe, I appreciate you taking the time out to come and speak to us. Matt, I especially apologize. I think I had you working for a different senator when I made your introduction, but Matt does work for Senator Roberts in the Senate Ag Committee. So with that, any parting words, gentlemen? And like I said, thank you very much for attending. So,
thanks for having us.
Okay. Yeah, thank you all.
Yeah, Joe, we'll make sure them Buckeyes get down in the bottom of the Big Ten ranking there. So, thank you,
thanks,
gentlemen.
Carl.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'd like to introduce our next guest that is with us here today. It is Dr. John Newton, and John is a AFBF economist and a native of Louisville, Kentucky, and received his PhD in agriculture economics and is a...
From where?
Like I said, he received his PhD in agricultural economics. And in a little stint at that other university to the south of us. Jeez, two Buckeyes, come on. With that, though, from 2004 to 2014, he worked for the USDA as an agricultural economist, working on issues related to commodity risk management and marketing. Following his service to USDA and the Congressional Committee, Dr. Newton was on faculty of the University of Illinois, where he led a collaborative effort on award-winning USDA-sponsored Farm Bill Tools Project. In 2014, Dr. Newton and his family relocated to Washington, D.C., where he first served as chief economist for National Milk Producers Federation before joining American Farm Bureau as Director of Market Intelligence in June of 2016. So with that, I'd like to welcome Mr. Newton to the stage and give us your insight of where we're headed.
Thanks a lot. So. Appreciate it. Thank you. The challenge is figuring out where to keep my water and not spill it on everything. sitting on the ground.
It's that Ohio State education for you. I really do appreciate the opportunity to join you guys, and after listening to President Duvall's speech, I asked Kate to change the title of my presentation to The Perfect Storm. What we're going to spend some time going over this morning is really a lot of the farm financial indicators that we look at American Farm Bureau Federation when we're crafting policy development process for members, and when we're visiting with folks on the Hill communicating the economic challenges in agriculture that really leads and contributes to our efforts around all of our advocacy efforts. And I think since I've been at Farm Bureau for over 2 years now, we've done a lot of letters to members of Congress talking about why we need to get a farm bill done, why we need to get these trade agreements done, why we need labor reform, et cetera. And one of the key things that we often highlight every single time is the challenges in the farm economy. We all know in this room that since 2013, net farm income has fallen by over 50%. It's fallen by $64 billion. And that's leading to some pretty tough financial times for a lot of farmers and ranchers across the country. It's impacting all sectors of agriculture uniformly. Dairy farmers are seeing lower cash receipts. Crop farmers, livestock producers, all of our members are seeing their financial situations in much tougher conditions than what they were just a few short years ago. And that really highlights our efforts on the Hill. Again, when we go and talk about why we need a farm bill, it's because the farm economy is in pretty poor shape. When you think about farm contribution to U.S. GDP, farms' contribution is less than 1%. In 2016, it was 0.07. That's the lowest level of the farm's contribution to the U.S. economy ever. U.S. agricultural's contribution to GDP is over $1 trillion, but the farm share of that portion is only about 13%, again at a record low. So while other sectors of the agricultural economy are doing very well, the farm sector is at its worst level in over a decade. Again, net farm income this year projected to come in at slightly more than $58 billion. And so with commodity prices falling, net farm income falling, one of the other challenges is the other side of the farm balance sheet. And we haven't seen the prices of inputs or land come down from where they were prior to the commodity price rally in 2012. And what this map here shows is the change in land values, crop land values from 2010, right after the recession. And note that agriculture was one of the few sectors of the economy that didn't suffer as much during that recession of 2009 due to the land-based value. But what we've seen in the U.S. is since 2010, cropland values have increased at the U.S. level on average more than 50%. But you can highlight your state on this map, and you see some places where cropland values have increased over 100%. For example, in North and South Dakota, cropland values are up over 100% since 2010. So with land prices remaining at fairly high levels, that's put some additional pressure on that farm balance sheet. When you think about crop prices falling by 40%, dairy prices falling by 50%, but the input costs haven't come down quite as bit. And that's what we see here. This is just on average across the United States. This would be the Chicago and Kansas City Fed, their percentage change in land values going back to 2009. And you see in 2010, 11, and 12, land values accelerated across large parts of the U.S. Again, when commodity prices were much higher, there was a higher willingness to pay for cropland, higher returns on those investments. At the same time, interest rates were at very low levels, making farmland a very, very attractive investment. So cash or farmland values increased significantly across much of the country, and what we've seen in recent years is that those farmland values have stabilized. They've remained relatively flat. The year-over-year changes in farmland values, we're not seeing a lot of those prices come down. As a matter of fact, when I was on faculty at the University of Illinois just a few short years ago, I traveled around the state quite a bit and talked to a lot of farmers, and one of the things I heard very often in those talks was a farmer would say, "This farmland, I've been watching this piece of ground for 20 years, and it finally came up for sale, and they went in and went by it." The demand for land remains very, very high, again, due to the returns from agriculture that we saw in 2012 and 13, but also due to the interest rate environment and the attractiveness of farmland as an investment. On the cash rent side, we see very similar patterns as what we saw on the cropland side of the equation. Cash rents accelerated very rapidly in following 2009, going into 2012 and 13. Again, that was due to the profitability of the ag space at that point in time. So we saw cash rents really accelerate. And then at the U.S. level, cash rents really haven't come down from the levels we saw prior to 2012. Cash rent average in the U.S. this year was $136 an acre. That's nearly identical with what it was the prior year. So we haven't seen the cash rents, we haven't seen the production cost come down dramatically, but we have seen the commodity prices come down quite a bit. So again, that's combined to really squeeze net farm income across the country. And there's no better chart than this here. The top line is the gross cash income. So we've seen that in recent years, it's down about 14%. That's gonna represent the cash receipts from all commodity sales across all of agriculture. So it came in at 2018, the projection is slightly more than $400 billion. Then when you look at the cash expense side of the equation, that's gonna include all of the expenses of production of agriculture. And what we've seen, it's only down about 8%. So cash receipts are down 14%. Expenses are only down about 8%. What does that do to the farmer's bottom line? It squeezes it, and net cash income is down 30%. And this is something, this is a chart I actually presented at USDA's Ag Outlook Conference back in February. And that conference, the focus of that was really about concentration in agriculture, concentration among the agribusinesses. And so farmers are one of the few sectors of the economy that face imperfect competition on both sides. When you produce a crop and you're raising milk and dairy cows, there are very few buyers of your product. You think about the poultry industry and how vertically integrated that is. And then on the input side, there are very few sellers of the product. So you face imperfect competition on both sides. And so what we've seen is with prices falling, your price takers on that side of the equation, with your input costs not going down, your price takers on that side. So it combines to really squeeze the farmer in this tough financial situation. And so with farmers being squeezed on both ends, one of the things that they've turned to is farm debt. And what we see in 2018, farm debt's projected to be record high at nearly $400 billion. Non-real estate debts remain relatively flat. It's increased a little bit in recent years, but it's the real estate debt that's increased nearly 70% over the last 5 or 6 years. So farmers have taken on more debt to buy more land, and farm debt continues to be record high. And so one of the things, when you think about everything that I just summarized about the crop prices, the commodity prices, net farm income, cash expenses not going down quite a bit, record debt, as President Duvall indicated, that creates an economic perfect storm. And so the next couple of slides are really gonna talk about some of the things that I'm really concerned about that could lead to much worse financial conditions in agriculture. And this is a concern that's shared by a number of folks throughout agriculture. I had an opportunity to sit and visit with folks at the Farm Credit Council last week, and this is one of the major factors that they're monitoring. With farm debt at record levels and commodity prices continue to decline, they're looking at the farmer's balance sheet, at their interest rates, at their demand for loans, at the loan performance index. These would all be leading indicators of poor conditions upcoming in the farm sector. So on the interest rate side of the equation, we know that the Fed has raised interest rates last week or the week before. They raised about 0.25%. But interest rates, these are going to be fixed interest rates, both for real estate and variable expenses. We've seen those climbing. These are interest rates from both the Chicago and Kansas City Fed. So the Chicago Fed has interest rates, fixed interest rates on operating loans at about 5.5%. In the 10th District, which represents part of Colorado, New Mexico, et cetera, we see that the operating loans are about 6.2%. Not only are the loans, the interest rates increasing, but the gap between the operating loan and the real estate loan interest rate is also increasing. The real estate remains a low-risk investment, so to make lending on the real estate less risky than making lending on the operating loan, and you're seeing those operating loan interest rates increase. And with the Fed doing what they did last week and expectations for interest rates to continue increasing, throughout this year and going into 2019. That's going to increase variable interest rates on a lot of existing loans. And so, again, that's going to put even more pressure on the farmer's balance sheet if their variable interest rates go up at a time when commodity prices remain relatively flat to lower. So these are some of the financial challenges in agriculture, and it's starting to show up in some of these indicators. What this chart shows is the number of farm loans that are being denied. This is the first quarter of 2018. So you can see, going back 2018, 2017, 2016, this is that Kansas City Fed district data. It shows 8% of farm loans on average are getting denied. That's up from what we saw in the prior 2 years, really indicating that the challenges in agriculture are very, very real. Lenders, when I talk to those folks at Farm Credit, one of the things that they indicated to me is that they're being much more stringent on the loans that they're giving out. They're asking farmers to be more prudent in some of their purchasing decisions, make sure that they have risk management plans in place. And so lenders are taking a much more active role now, given the risky environment that they're lending into. And then one of the other things, this is the ratio of bad debt out there. Now, this is not, it's not alarming. It's not an alarming trend that it's increasing, but it is increasing. I think that's one of the factors, again, that's going to, that's a leading indicator of the health of the farm economy. So what this is the ratio of non-performing loans to total loans. And what we see in 2018, the ratio has increased about 0.04 of a percentage point, so it is increasing. On the farm credit banks, that's going to be your top right chart. The increase is much more noticeable and more pronounced than the Farm Credit Administration associations. But what we do see is that the ratio of non-performing debt to total debt continues to climb, indicating and confirming our numbers that show it's not a great financial situation in agriculture. And I think one of the last lines, you know, you talk about bad debt. If we look at bankruptcy levels, that's another factor that we've been monitoring. Bankruptcies in the first quarter of 2018 came in at 116. That's Chapter 12 family farm bankruptcies. That's down 2 from what we saw the first quarter of 2017. So when people looked at that aggregate number, and we had about 500 farm bankruptcies in 2017, when they looked at the first quarter of 2018, showing that it was down slightly, I think a lot of folks missed the boat and then they didn't really dive into that district court and look at what was happening regionally. And so when we dive in and look regionally at what's happening with bankruptcies, we see in parts of the country, like the Corn Belt, like some of our Northeast dairy states, bankruptcies are up over 50%. In some places, they're up over 100%. For example, in the Cotton Belt, you see the bankruptcies up over 100%. And then again, in parts of the Midwest, Chapter 12 bankruptcies are up. We're going to continue to monitor that information. It's released quarterly from the U.S. courts. So we'll see that data throughout the rest of 2018. But when I sit and visit with the farm credit folks, I visit with the co-bank folks, everybody in agriculture anticipates this number to continue to increase for the rest of this year. So it's definitely a very tough financial environment for agriculture. And I think, as President Duvall indicated, when you think about the trade, you think about us being at the tip of the spear with the farm economy where it is, we can't take much more, and certain sectors of the farm economy can't take much more at all before things are going to get a lot worse. And so where do we go from here? These are some numbers I just put together this morning. So USDA, when we talk to them and visit with them about the farm economy, what they say to us is, well, debt-to-asset ratios aren't where they used to be. And so the figure on the right here is going to be the debt-to-asset ratios going back. Many of you may have been around in the 80s. I certainly wasn't working in agriculture. I think I was just born in 82, so I missed that farm financial crisis. But what we saw back then was debt-to-asset ratios climbing upwards of 20% in 1985. And so USDA looks at 2018 and says, well, debt-to-asset ratios have improved in 2018. So I thought, well, with farm debt at record levels, what type of depreciation in the asset values would we need to see in the next few years and to get debt-to-asset ratios back to where they were in the 80s? And so if we look, the highest debt-to-asset ratio that we ever saw in agriculture was in 1985 at 22%. Now, interest rates were a little bit different in the 80s than they are today, I'll add. But In 2018, the debt-to-asset ratio is projected at 13%. So let's say with higher interest rates and poor farm commodity prices, we see some erosion in the asset base. Let's keep farm debt fixed at $389 billion. If we see a 10% decline in asset values, that's going to push our debt-to-asset ratio to 14%, which still remains below the historical average of 15%. If we saw a 20% decline in asset values, we'd see a debt-to-asset ratio of 16%. And then if we saw a 40% decline in asset values, we'd see a debt-to-asset ratio start to approach the levels of the 1980s. Now, that's just looking at one side of the equation. With continued poor performance of commodity prices, you could see asset values deteriorate as well as debt levels increase, and that would accelerate the rate at which debt-to-asset ratios could climb. So these are some of the financial indicators that we're monitoring to keep a pulse on what's happening, and it really does motivate us when we're going to the Hill talking about why we need to get all those other issues fixed so that we see higher commodity prices moving forward and a healthier farm economy. So what are some things in our advocacy toolbox, some of the things that we do on a regular basis? I'm going to talk about a couple of the wins that we've gotten in the last year, but then some of the challenges that we face, some of the headwinds that we have. And President Duvall summarized a lot of these in very great detail, but I'll just highlight some of the ones. And so when we were visiting with the ag committees late last year, especially on the Senate side, when we visit with the House side, it was talking a lot about, well, how can we make the farm safety nets better, like fixing ARC, fixing dairy, fixing cotton, fixing PLC, making tweaks to those programs. That's what we heard a lot on the House side. But when we would visit with folks on the Senate side, it was, let's roll back the regulations. Let's work on the other side of the balance sheet. Can we do things to cut costs of farming? And because it has an equal effect on farm profitability, either you get higher prices or more support payments, or you lower the cost, and each one of those can increase farm profitability. So on the Senate side, a lot of the stuff that when we would talk with Chairman Roberts' staff was how do we roll back the regulations on farmers and ranchers. And I think I'll just highlight this one slide. I think when President Trump came in the office, he said for each new regulation that they put on, he was going to take off how many? Two. And when he came to our convention, President Trump came to American Farm Bureau's convention in January, and the first sitting president to come to our convention in a number of years, he indicated that for each new regulation, they've actually taken back how many? Who was that convention, by a show of hands? It was 22. So for each new regulation that we've added, the administration, and this isn't just for agriculture, obviously, it's in a broad array of areas, but they've taken off 22 regulations for each new one. So you think about our efforts on waters of the U.S., our efforts on regulatory reform, those are all things that can help the farmer's balance sheet because it reduces your transactions costs. Another thing to think about, we USDA Secretary Perdue and Undersecretary Northey, they rolled all of the USDA mission areas that deal with farmers, FSA, NRCS, and RMA into an FPAC mission so that farmers, when they're going in to do their conservation practices or their crop insurance or their FSA loans or farm program payments, it's all going to be under one roof. And that reduces the transactions cost. It saves you time and saves resources. So there are a lot of areas where they're trying to make some common sense reform to help farmers and ranchers. I think the other thing that happened at the end of last year was pretty significant tax reform. And Pat Wolf handles our tax lobbying in this effort. Did a tremendous job helping get the issues of farmers and ranchers and fix some of those challenges. We got the grain glitch fixed in the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018, but if you look overall at the tax package, what it did, it lowered the effective rate of taxes for farmers and ranchers. So you talk about commodity prices being low, one way to increase profitability is to lower your tax obligation, and the tax bill in December most certainly did that, and that puts money in people's pockets right away. I think the other challenge is obviously immigration, and we know that the House heard us on this issue last week. We were very, very engaged in that process. I won't say much more on the immigration front other than what President Duvall has said a number of times, and that is we're either going to import our food or we're going to import our labor. So American Farm Bureau continues to be very, very engaged on the labor front because we know how important it is to our members. I was in Idaho 2 weeks ago. I traveled the state And they estimated, those farmers that I talked to in Idaho estimated that 80% of their labor force was illegal. So whether that's a hops farmer that needs 300 people to harvest his hops, or a dairy farmer that needs to make sure there's somebody there in the morning at 3 to help you milk cows several times a day, those farmers had some very, very real issues on immigration, and we're very, very concerned about that. So we continue to work on that, and I know folks at the state level obviously work on that on a day-to-day basis as well. I think one of the other big issues that we've spent a lot of time recently really communicating the concerns of agriculture is on the renewable fuel standard, on RFS. We've been very engaged with the administration, with the EPA, and with Secretary Perdue on the RFS, and quite frankly, the proposals to gut the RFS. So the renewable fuel standard, for those of you that may not know a lot about it, we're blending the ethanol into the U.S. gasoline supply. We use about 40% of our corn to produce ethanol. We're having the same growth rate in the soybean oil complex for soybean-based biodiesel. So we're using more of our commodities into the fuel supply. And the principal compliance instrument for the renewable fuel standard are what are called RINs. These are certificates that are generated when ethanol is blended into the fuel supply. And so if an obligated party doesn't blend enough ethanol, they have to buy RINs on the open market to demonstrate to the EPA that they've met their volume requirements. And so these RIN prices move based on supply and demand conditions. And there were efforts by many in the oil space to really cap the value of RINs, so that if you didn't comply with the RFS, if you didn't blend enough biofuels, your penalty or your cost of compliance would have been much, much lower. So efforts to cap RIN prices or have RINs generated on exports, all of those undermine the RFS program. So we've been very engaged in that effort, but we've also been engaged in trying to get year-round E15 sales, because that would increase ethanol demand and increase demand for corn. So that would help when commodity prices are lower if we're putting more of the ethanol into the fuel supply. So we've been engaged in that effort. I believe 2 weeks ago, the proposal was to roll out this RINs for ethanol exports, and the White House tabled that discussion. But it's certainly a very concerning issue given how much the corn crop every single year goes into ethanol production, and how much now of the soybean crop is in soybean oil and effectively soybean-based biodiesel. So again, we continue to work on those efforts at our level as well. And I think, you know, this chart really says a lot. This is where we do business, in the export markets. This is where U.S. farmers and ranchers, these are our principal export markets. So if you look at Canada, Mexico, China, Japan, combined they represent more than 50% of our agricultural exports. And 25% of the products that we produce go overseas. So we know how important trade is to the farm economy. And as President Duvall indicated, we've been very, very engaged on trade. We've been walking that tightrope to make sure that our message is heard, but not to get on the wrong side of the administration on some of these tough issues. But we know that with 95% of the world's population living outside of the United States, the success for U.S. agriculture really relies on creating new markets, taking down some of these barriers to trade, and getting more market access opportunities for the crops, livestock that we produce here in the U.S. So we've been very, very engaged on the trade front, and hope that we see a quick resolution on some of these issues, because it is very, very important to the farm economy. And there's no better way than to talk about this slide. I think, you know, we've seen what the trade rhetoric, what a tweet has done to markets. And so these are just several key commodities and what those prices have done as a result of the tariff threats, the tit for tat back and forth that we've seen on tariffs. If you look, we'll start with corn. Just in a matter of weeks, corn's down 12%. New crop corn futures down 12% in a matter of weeks. Now, it coincides with very, very favorable growing conditions. I was talking to many folks last night, and they said the corn crop looks really, really good. I'm going to get a lot of windshield time later this afternoon as I drive to Indiana to look. But favorable crop conditions combined with all the trade rhetoric has contributed to a 12% decline in corn prices. That's 50 cents a bushel. On soybeans, same time period, a matter of weeks, lost 15% in that new crop soybean contract, over $1.40 per bushel in that soybean price. If you take that and say that, let's say that's ultimately realized by the time combines start rolling, and we usually sell a lot of our soybeans right after harvest. You take $1.40 on a 4 billion bushel soybean crop, that's billions of dollars in a matter of weeks, billions of dollars coming out of that market potentially. So we need quick resolutions on these issues because of how important it is to the farm economy. Net farm income is only $60 billion. We're over here wiping out billions in a tweet. So it's very, very important. These markets do move and impacts a lot of farmers and ranchers. Same thing on the wheat. We've seen wheat down 13%. But a lot of those crops are still on the ground. And so there's still a lot of uncertainty. Hopefully we can get this resolved. Get this resolved by the time China comes in to start buying soybeans. Right now their market, as primarily in the southern hemispheres, they're getting beans out of Brazil. Argentina did have some drought concerns. So there are cases where we're exporting soybeans to Argentina right now because they have a short crop and they need it for their crushing facilities. But the point is we need to get these trade disagreements resolved by the time we harvest, and that can help the crop guys. But what about the livestock space? What about the farmers, the dairy farmers that milk every single day and need to take that product to market? When Mexico announced their retaliation list, as well as China, it included a number of dairy products, and I'll just highlight dairy. 25% tariff on cheese. A lot of the dry milk products, the whey products that we export to China are seeing 25, 35% tariffs. And what has that done to the milk price? This is the July Class 3 milk futures price. It's taken $2 per hundredweight out of that market in a few weeks. $2 per hundredweight for milk that farmers are selling next month. That's billions of dollars out of the dairy economy. So these have very, very real movements, very, very real impacts on our members, and especially certain segments of the farm economy. So, again, this really motivates our efforts, and we hope that the administration can come to a quick resolution on this, because as President Duvall indicated, while some sectors can certainly weather it, some sectors certainly cannot weather and continue to weather these low commodity prices. I'll move a little bit into the farm bill. I didn't put a lot of information on the farm bill, but be certain to get into the weeds if anybody has questions about the farm bill. But this is the Congressional Budget Office score of the farm bill prior to the House and Senate bills. So this is the baseline that agriculture has to work with. The farm bill is a 10-year package, or it's a 5-year package, but scored over 10 years, estimated at approximately $860 billion over 10. 80% of that's going to be in the nutrition programs, so that's your SNAP. And then the other 20% is going to be in a lot of the programs that we depend on, your crop insurance, your conservation, and your commodity title programs. And what we've seen in both the House and Senate versions of the Farm Bill is that they're budget neutral. That means their spending is also right at that $867 billion mark. And when you compare the House and Senate Farm Bills, the House bill that was passed last week by that thin margin, and the Senate bill that was voted out of committee, what we see is both of those contribute nearly $90 billion in deficit reduction to the economy. So farmers and ranchers have already done their part in the budget savings. It's spending $90 billion less than the 2014 Farm Bill. And if you compare it to the budget score before the Farm Bill in February, we're saving over $112 billion. So agriculture is doing its part in deficit reduction. I'll speak briefly about what we know in the House Farm Bill. The House bill doesn't make major changes to the Title I programs. It keeps Arc County mostly unchanged. It uses RMA yields as the primary yield source. There are some modifications to the price loss coverage program to create a floating reference price. Then on the conservation title on the House Farm Bill, they've gotten rid of the CSP program and moved those funds into an enhanced EQIP program, but also have proposed significant expansion of the Conservation Reserve Program. Both of them continue funding for trade programs, as Joe indicated. You know, the House and Senate Farm Bill have those MAP and FMD fundings. And I think the other thing to highlight is on both the House and Senate bill, they do create a national animal disease preparedness, an animal vaccine bank, in the event of a FMD outbreak. On the Senate side, they make a few modifications to Arc County, but leave PLC unchanged. Base acres are unchanged primarily in both bills. There's no proposed changes on base acres in the Senate bill. The Senate bill leaves conservation pretty much untouched. for the most part. I think they do expand CRP by 1 million acres, and it also does include the FMD vaccine bank, but I don't believe it's funded. I'd be happy to go into any of the details on both the House and Senate provisions, but I do want to show you guys something, and I know I don't know how I'm doing on time, but there is one thing I want to show you at the end, because while we've gotten the House Farm Bill done, we're going to work this week as amendments come in to get the things done in the Senate, hopefully get a Farm Bill out of there and start working on a conference in July and get a Farm Bill done before it expires in September 30th of 2018. But you guys have been really supportive in that effort. So if you look here, this is how your member voted on the Farm Bill. It was pretty partisan. We had all the Republicans, 20 of them defected to the Democratic side. So we went 213 to 211 with 20 Republicans in that 211 count and 191 Democrats. But these are the members of Congress who supported agriculture in the House Farm Bill. We've got a lot of work left to do on the Senate side. I think it's real important, as engaged as we were on the House, to stay that engaged on the Senate. And Kate, if anybody wants these slides, feel free to share them after I leave here. But with that, I want to get into one thing. This is really the call to action for a lot of folks, and I'd like, Kate, if we have a chance to play this video. This is our advocacy video on the Farm Bill, and then I'll come back up and take some questions, if that's okay.
Listen here, brother. The House just passed the Farm Bill. Now it's time for you to make a difference and contact your senators. Tell them we need a Farm Bill now.
If any of you guys see Andrew Wamsley, don't tell him I showed you guys that video. He texted to me last night. He says, I'm going to regret sending you this video. I said, yeah, you are. Do I have time for any questions? I really do appreciate joining you guys, by the way. Yes, sir. Great question. So, first one, I'll tackle the RINs. When they buy the RINs, so those who blend more ethanol, let's say you blend up to E15 or higher grades of ethanol, you have RINs. So you demonstrate that you've met your volume obligation, and then you have surplus RINs that you can sell on the open market to those who have not met their obligation. So think of RINs effectively as like a cap and trade system. That's really what they do. They have value. But if you undermine the value of those by artificially capping the price or allowing RINs to be generated for export, that means somebody that's not meeting their ethanol obligations, it's a lot cheaper for them to buy RINs and not blend the biofuels. That undermines the energy security and independence and statute and intent of the RFS. And then on payment limitations, just on the Senate side, because right now that's one of our number one challenges is, not only payment limitations, but means testing. So I'm not sure what Grassley amendments we're going to see, but rumors are we're going to see something on AGI, so an AGI limitation on the crop insurance side. We met last week with the Crop Insurance Coalition and the conservation folks to talk about this issue. The conservation folks lent their support for that conservation and crop insurance compliance and helped to beat back any amendments on that side, but it's going to be a tough uphill battle. In 2012, we had 60 yes votes for an AGI limitation. 2013, we had 55 yes votes now. And if we start to do the whip count now, we only have 25 friends and close to 50 people that'd be supportive of an AGI payment, AGI means testing on crop insurance. On the payment limitation front, we'll continue to fight those efforts. I don't believe the House bill had any payment limitations. And I haven't seen, at this point, any draft Senate amendments on payment limitations. But we are supportive. We do not support payment limitations. We support a separate payment limitations on the peanut program. So we'll continue to abide and follow our policy book hard and try to get support to beat back any of those kind of harmful amendments. Yes, sir.
On the Senate side, we're talking about combining the EQIP with some of the conservation programs. What about the, what kind of levels do you see currently? You know, we have like 60% for livestock on that. What is that going to be?
So, and Don Parrish in our office has really been leading the charge on these conservation issues in the Farm Bill, but the House bill does get rid of CSP, rolls the funding in the EQIP, but gets rid of that livestock carve-out of 60%. The thought is 60% of a small pot or some percentage of a very big pot to the effect that the livestock folks are still going to be the same or better off under this revised program. But there will be an opportunity to address these kind of things in conference. One of the things that they indicated to us as we were looking at the House bill and some of the proposed changes, like, for example, AFBF policy doesn't support a CRP cap of 29 million acres. If we were to try to amend that down, that costs money in the CBO baseline. So we'd have to find savings somewhere else. And so in talking with both the House and Senate side, they said, look, save some of your ammunition. Let's work on some of this in conference because it doesn't have a CBO score once we get there. So on the Senate side, they don't have the same CSP EQIP issue. So if they pass a farm bill this week and we get to conference, you know, any of our concerns can be elevated, and we can raise it during the conference. Yes, Mr. Veach. I'd have to look. I don't believe they did. Okay. It is the cropland value, but all of those competitive forces will be at play. When you think about, you know, in parts of California, as you see that urban encroachment in the farmland, that's going to contribute to the higher crop prices or cropland values. The other one is the low interest rates. I was at a conference in Kansas City last year with a number of investment firms that make investments in the farmland. And with interest rates being as low as they are, they look at that as a very, very attractive investment longer term. But they indicated to me one of the big challenges is as interest rates go up, it's not as attractive of an investment. We still see a lot of demand for farmland. I believe if we look, 90% of the farmland transactions are farmer to farmer. So there's still pretty high demand for cropland. That's why I did that sensitivity analysis, just to see how much of a decline we'd need to see in asset values for debt to asset ratios to get back to those 1980 levels. And I can't put forth a scenario that sees a 40% decline in asset values next year, but certainly continued erosion in these commodity prices, trade uncertainty, all of that combined, as President Duvall indicated, that's a perfect storm. Yes, sir. So, a wise man once told me, and I ignored it partially, he said, if it's a white commodity, don't touch it. They said, stay away from dairy, cotton, and sugar, and rice. I ignored them. I worked on dairy for a number of years. But I know, as President Duvall indicated, any kind of negative amendment on sugar, we're going to be right there with them to try to beat that back. I think the ideal scenario would be like we had in the House, where they put all of these bad amendments in one. It makes it so ridiculous that it's easy to support, and that's what we did on the House side. We had AGI, means testing, all of these bad amendments, we put it into one package and were able to defeat it. If we could do that on the Senate side, that'd be great, but I doubt it. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Great presentation. And with that, we'd like to thank Dr. Newton and President Duvall for coming to Michigan and taking time out of their busy schedules to come and speak to us about what they see is happening in the agriculture world. So with that, we have a little gift to present to you. So thank you very much.
driving to Indiana. I might eat this on
the way there.
Could I say one thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
We got, one thing I didn't mention that I wanted to mention is Mayor Kay retired, and we restructured the way we handle farm policy and the farm bill. And we had started the process back several years ago when we started the farm bill working group and got to the board. Board made the recommendations to the House. But then when Mayor Kay retired, we tried to figure out how we might could do it better. And one of the things I wanted to take on as a challenge was, how do we minimize commodity groups within Farm Bureau and regions within Farm Bureau from not fighting, but separating, dividing ourselves. And I thought the best way to do that is create a big team, a Farm Bill team. Really, no one really have a point person, but not have anybody that was totally responsible for it. So what we did within the organization at American Farm Bureau, we have Farm Bill team. That team is incorporates Andrew Wansley, who was on the video there. Andrew Wansley as the point person to communicate everything. But then all the people around the halls of American Farm Bureau specializing in certain areas of the Farm Bill on that team. And then another link that I think has been absolutely a wonderful addition to it is we've incorporated all the national fairs from all our state Farm Bureaus around the country as part of that Farm Bill team. And Andrew has had weekly Farm Bill calls at 12 o'clock on Tuesday. Several weeks when a lot was going on, he had multiple calls. And then on those calls, we've had the two gentlemen that you saw on the video a while ago, that or the webcast, they were on one of our calls. We've had Chairman Conaway on one of our calls. We've had Chairman Roberts on one of our calls, Ms. Stabenow's group on, Mr. Peterson's staff on one of those calls. So we were constantly feeding information. What I was shooting for was transparency and input from every region and every commodity around the country. And I think that it's been a tremendous improvement in the process, and it's helped us stay better united and helped us a lot better for us to hear from you. Because, you know, when our national affairs people hear you talk, and then they turn around and talk to us, we make sure we're current on our information that we're pumping into Washington. So I just wanted you to be aware of that change that we made. I'm real excited about it. I think it's been hugely successful, and I think that the people out in the state that work for us feel like they've been more included, and that's what I wanted to accomplish. Transparency, communication, working together, and having a united voice, and I think we've come a long way of getting there. So thank you for letting me come back and share that.
John also had another issue that he wanted to just make some comments on. So, John, please.
I've got to leave and go to Indiana, but I apologize for not doing this earlier. Michael Neveu joined our staff as an economist 2 weeks ago. He's going to be staying with you guys for the rest of the conference, so I just wanted to make that introduction. Feel free to stop and visit with Michael and give him a warm welcome to the Farm Bureau family. So, thanks.
Welcome. With that, as you see, our schedule is up here. If you're not sure what room your breakout session is, we have a number of staff that are more than willing to help you find your way. So with that, we will break, and we'll get started with our breakout session shortly. Thank you.